All right, so John, this is a repeat of an earlier attempt on a summary of a recent workshop at the KITP on singularities, and especially the quantum nature. So I will go through the same talk and probably have to speed up in the beginning, because last time I didn't have as much time in the end. But first, can anybody hear me? Or are there any problems? There's no echo, at least.
Everything seems to be fine here.
Okay, good. So, well, before I start, I'm not going to give many references during the talk. You can see the web page on the title, so you can see the individual talk that I'm going to summarize here, and they also have references. And on the slides, I will just mention the names of the speakers who presented those topics, so you can more easily find the relevant talks. So, if we go to slide number 2, there's a summary of the main topics. So, the main focus was on space-like singularities, not arbitrary singularities, which could also be time-like, or null singularities were also allowed as a special limiting case of space-like ones. And the main aim was to deal with dynamically relevant situations in cosmology, also for a black hole collapse, and these singularities tend to be not time-like, so that was why the focus was really on space-like singularities. And also, from the quantum perspective, they are more difficult to understand, so it's a greater challenge to look at space-like singularities. And then finally, there's an argument, if one believed in cosmic censorship, that time-like singularities anyway would not be relevant, so these are all the reasons that that one to focus on space-like singularities. Now, other than that, there's not much information on what the singularity typically should be. We know that they are generically singularities because of the singularity theorem, but they don't tell us much about the properties, especially, well, most, the best-known singularities are curvature singularities, but it's not proven that any singularity will be of this type. So that certainly makes a more general analysis difficult. But there are some indications which give at least some kind of behavior of singularities which might be at least a larger class, if not generic, which is a BKL picture. And that has the additional advantage that it allows one to reduce inhomogeneous situations, which would be more difficult to deal with by homogeneous ones. So that will be the first point that I'm going to review. And on the classical side, that was also covered. Is there an echo, or does somebody have the microphone on?
I think the last person who joined in may have the microphone on, because until then everything was fine.
Okay, so still seems to be there. So on the classical side, there's also still ongoing research. So it's not been proven, but there's growing support numerically and from MIDI superspace models, which really strengthen these indications for the BKL picture. Now, since there are some these general problems on the full classification of singularities, it also certainly has a reflection on possible quantum resolution. So some of these scenarios suggest simplifications, but because the general situation is not completely known, it's not clear at all what resolution, if that is expected from quantum gravity, should mean. So that was one of the main points also that was discussed, to start with the quantum applications. And then afterward, there were several specific cases, both from string theory and loop quantum gravity, which presented examples of possible resolutions using different definitions and different mechanisms. So that will be the main part that I will describe here. If you go to slide number 3, there's first a simple example of a classical solution which exhibits singularities. It's not isotropic, it's Bianchi 1 model, so they are three independent metric components, spatial metric components, A1, A2, A3, not just one as an isotropic models. And if one puts this metric into Einstein's equations that can easily be solved, and one obtains the Gardner solution, where these three scale factors need to be certain powers of proper time, and the exponents appearing in those powers have to satisfy two relations. The sum has to be 1, and the sum of the squares 2. So that leaves one free parameter, which can conveniently be done in this form using U, a real parameter larger than 1 or equal to 1. And for each parameter, for each different value of U in that range, one gets a different solution. Now, singularity then appears at when T approaches 0, so it's really a curvature singularity, as one can see at the bottom, unless this parameter U is infinite, which would correspond just to Minkowski space. This is certainly quite a special system, but it illustrates one important feature, which is the difference that can occur in anisotropic models compared to isotropic ones. If we look at the approach to the singularity to T equals 0, then it's clear from these relations that the exponents have to satisfy that one of these exponents has to be negative. So if we approach T equals 0 from larger values, then one of these directions, one of the scale factors will actually expand, although the total volume goes to 0. So that's certainly quite different from an isotropic singularity. But it is the general situation that occurs in anisotropic models. And that means that isotropic models are certainly more special than anisotropic ones, and there's a key difference which one should take into account if one analyzes singularities in any such models or even in quantizations. This model is also relevant for the inhomogeneous situation that's reviewed on slide number 4. One can try to understand the inhomogeneous situations by certain approximations, and one possible approximation that was suggested early on is to look at the different rates of divergence of individual terms in Einstein's equation. Some of them might diverge more strongly if we approach a singularity and then dominate over others, and that might give simplifications if the less divergent terms are ignored. So the asymptotic equations should be simpler. The BKL conjecture is the most specific realization. So the observation here is that it's actually time derivative terms in Einstein's equation which are most important. So one can ignore in these asymptotic equations spatial derivatives, which means that the situation would not really be inhomogeneous from the dynamical perspective, at least. Initial conditions can still be inhomogeneous and each point will have a different geometry. But in these asymptotic equations, there are no spatial derivatives, so each point will just behave independently, even of neighboring points, and will just be described by a mini-superspace model corresponding to that particular point, which is homogeneous but still anisotropic. So that's why this anisotropic behavior of homogeneous model that I described on the previous slide is important for this general approach to singularities, even if such a simplification occurs as in the BKL conjecture. So this was first seen by just looking at Einstein's equation and doing some asymptotic analysis. It's by now, as I mentioned, quite well supported. And one example where one can see that quite easily is given by Gaudi models. These are inhomogeneous models, but there's only one direction, one spatial direction, which is inhomogeneous, given by the coordinate x in the line element written on this slide number 4 here. And in this particular Gaudi model, the metric components have a certain form also visible from that line element. So here, in this form, the singularity is approached when t goes to infinity. If one writes down Einstein's equations for the two independent metric components, p and q here, lambda is just like Laplace function, so there's no field equation for it. The only three functions of P and Q, and they are two partial differential equations in time and this one spatial coordinate. If one looks at these equations, they are certainly time derivative and spatial derivative terms, but the spatial derivatives all have a factor of e to the minus 2t, so if one approaches a singularity, if t goes to infinity, they are suppressed, except that there is a subtlety because one term, this qx squared in the first equation, actually has a p minus t, so if p would be growing linearly in t, then this term would not be suppressed, so that is why the analysis is not as easy as one might think just by looking at these equations. One really has to see, one has to have much more information on the behavior of p. But that has been analyzed, and there is support from this analytical analysis that the BKL conjecture and this model is true. And for more generic situations without symmetries, there's also a growing numerical support that such a behavior is realized. So then one can really at least use that as a starting point, so one can reduce the dynamics even of inhomogeneous spacetimes and inhomogeneous space-like singularities mainly to the behavior that's realized in anisotropic but homogeneous models. There's a more precise method. One can do some kind of self-consistency test. One first ignores all these spatial derivative terms or any spatial dependence, then solves the simplified Einstein equations, gets a solution which is then called velocity term dominated, and that is certainly not an exact solution, but one can then derive the so-called consistent potentials by plugging that solution into the not simplified equations. So since the solution is going to be inhomogeneous in general, although spatial derivatives have initially been ignored, the spatial derivative terms in Einstein's equation will give additional potential terms which one can include in the next order of the approximation and then proceed and get a closer description of the exact solutions. So that usually implies that the behavior is not as in this Kasner solution, as shown earlier, which was the simplest anisotropic model, but there might be more complicated potential terms. So the Kasner solution is like free motion in classical mechanics, and any of these spatial derivative terms would or could be described by additional potentials which imply reflections of this free motion. So there's not a single Kasner epoch given by just one value of this parameter u, but there are usually reflections between different epochs, so there's a succession of periods in which different values of u are realized. One example is also an anisotropic model, homogeneous, but with intrinsic curvature on spatial slices, as in the Bianchi 9 model. So that's also called mixed master, especially the behavior that's resulting from the analysis. Here, these reflections have been analyzed in some detail, and there's a specific map of these values of u between different Kasner epochs, a family of values u labeled by an integer n for the epochs. And that map can be computed, so that describes these reflections quite well. That map is chaotic, so they are certainly are much more complicated behavior than one would have in the Kasner solution. Instead of that completely solvable behavior, one has a chaotic solution here. So that is, in this case, just one homogeneous model, but one should expect that this also in general is relevant for inhomogeneous singularities analyzed in the BKR picture. So also these inhomogeneous singularities, although they can dynamically be reduced to the dynamics of homogeneous models, can be quite complicated because the approach to the singularity might be chaotic, and then also the structure of a classical singularity could be rather complicated. A fractal, for instance. But This is relevant certainly for the classical analysis. However, if we are interested in possible quantum behavior, then we shouldn't use the full dynamical solution. We would certainly just evolve for a finite range of time. We wouldn't evolve all the way to the singularity, because at some point the classical general relativity equations would just break down and we would have to use quantum gravity. So we should only trust that behavior for a finite number, for a finite range of time, and that means that there are also just a finite number of these reflections of the potential, but that already means that the corresponding discrete system is not really chaotic in that interpretation, because it's chaotic only if one really looks at all these infinitely many reflections. If one only considers finite number of reflections, then it's still complicated, but it's at least in a technical mathematical sense not chaotic. And to make this more quantitative, one can look at the number of reflections that typically occur, and the number of reflections is quite low. It certainly depends on initial values, but these examples given here illustrate that one really shouldn't expect too many reflections. For instance, if just the logarithm of volume changes by 10 to the 60, which is a huge number as a factor of volume, one gets only 250 reflections. Or if one tries to put in more realistic numbers describing a universe like ours, then between the Planck scale and the Hubble scale, there are typically only 3 to 5 reflections. So this whole complicated Bianchi 9 behavior certainly does not seem to be relevant, at least if one uses these rather simple dimensional arguments in putting in the Planck scale and the Hubble scale. So there are certain implications summarized on slide number 6. If that's true, then one would only need to focus on a single Kastner epoch, so there are only a few reflections and each reflection happens in a short amount of time. So most likely, when one crosses the Planck scale, Planck curvature, which is where one expects quantum effects to set in, then this will just be described by a Kastner motion, a single Kastner epoch, and any potentials or inhomogeneities, if that picture is correct, could be ignored. So it suggests that analyzing the Kastner model also in quantum gravity will at least give some good indications on the possible general behavior that would be realized in the particular quantum gravity description used. So that is the optimistic expectation. There's certainly also some issues that still have to be analyzed. In particular, just because quantum gravity changes the dynamics and the BKL picture is based on an asymptotic analysis of the classical dynamics, one still certainly has to make sure that one can use at least these features that have been made use of in certain arguments, whatever one is saying about singularities. So the asymptotic statements that are used are certainly well supported classically, but whenever one changes the dynamics, one also has to make sure that these asymptotic statements still remain a good description also of the new dynamics of quantum gravity, possibly. So one example where one probably should be quite careful is whenever there are bounces, because then the volume has a lower bound, which is positive, so the complete asymptotic regime is just avoided by the bounds, and then one has to be more specific in statements about initial values, for instance, whether or not the region around the bounds should really be considered asymptotic from the point of view of the BKL analysis, or maybe was not sufficiently close to the classical singularity. So that illustrates already some of the issues that will be relevant for quantum gravity, which brings us to the next, basically to the rest of the talk, which is on possible quantum gravity statements. But before looking into any specific resolution or proposal for resolution, one has to agree or at least define a possible candidate for such a resolution. And the main three choices that were discussed, first of all, that's really the main one. So the main examples are in the first category, which is a resolution mechanism as a result of non-singular solutions for quantum degrees of freedom, for the degrees of freedom that are relevant for the quantum gravity that's being used. But certainly just finding one non-singular solution would not be enough. One has to make sure that there are non-singular solutions which in a certain semi-classical limit or in some regime which approaches semi-classical behavior would correspond to a classical solution that would be singular. So in that case, one could say that the classical singularity has been resolved. There's a solution which has the same semi-classical behavior far away from the singularity, but provides a well-defined description at the place of the classical singularity. The second possibility is a more general statement, possibly, but also less specific, which requires that all observables that one can compute in a particular theory would be well-behaved at all times, and then certainly there would be no singularity, at least no observable implications of a singularity. And then finally, there's a possibility that fundamental theory might provide a theory of initial conditions. So instead of appearing like a singularity as in classical solutions, that would actually be a place where one would not only choose initial conditions to avoid a singularity, but where the initial conditions would even be dictated by the fundamental theory. And then this place would not be considered singular because it would be an essential ingredient of any solution of the theory. So these are the main examples, and there are examples, specific cases for each of them. As I said, the main ones are in the first category, and that will also be the main cases that I will be describing. So I will start with string theory on slide number 7. Also, within each approach, there are different versions of resolving singularities, different cases that have been studied by different means. In string theory, the main approach in general, but also concerning singularities, is the ADS-CFT correspondence, which relates the bulk geometry of a space-time that one is interested in and which would have a singularity to certain correlation functions of a field theory that's living at the boundary and which is not gravitational, but which is conjectured to have the same information as the gravitational theory in the bulk. So there's also a quite general statement here, because the boundary theory in general is non-singular, so it has unitary evolution. It's never going to break down. So if one can really reproduce all aspects of the bulk, then also the bulk cannot be singular, because it can just as well be described by the same unitary evolution. But whether or not that is possible, especially from a relativistic viewpoint, is not clear. There might be horizons, and whenever there are horizons, it looks difficult to reproduce what's happening beyond them by a theory that is just living at the boundary. So how that is still possible in some cases, at least, will be described on the next few slides. And that also gives at least some indications on how such a resolution might happen specifically. So this is not only the main approach followed, it's also the longest part that I will be describing here concerning string theory. There are a few other statements. Some of them use string perturbation theory, like brain gas or tachyon condensation. Matrix theory is being used in some cases. In others, it's just classical supergravity, which all of which I am just going to describe briefly. But at least the last one is from the perspective described before, rather interesting, because that looks the application that's most closely related to the BKL picture. So that might give some indication on whether it can also be realized with some ingredients from quantum gravity. So on slide 8, we have a very brief summary of the ADS-EFT correspondence. So the bulk geometry has to be asymptotically ADS for the correspondence to work, at least in current formulations. And the boundary theory is a conformal field theory, which in this case is, well, to capture the full bulk geometry, it's conjectured to be SUN super Young-Mill theory with where the supersymmetry is rather high, so it's a so-called N equals 4 super Young-Mill theory. The basic correspondence is formulated in terms of coupling constants, so we have the string coupling constant GS, which is just the square of the Young-Mills coupling constant characterizing the boundary theory. So that's one of the basic relations. And the second one relates the ADS radius, that's a capital L here, and the spring length to a combination of the Young-Mills coupling constant and the number N that appears in the SUN group of the Young-Mills theory. So the combination of the square of the Young-Mills coupling constant and N is usually called a Tolt coupling, that is the lambda here. So these are two relations which relate the basic parameters, the Young-Mills coupling and N on the boundary side, and the string coupling and the ADS radius on the spring side. Then, in addition to these parameters, there are more specific descriptions to extract information from one side using calculations on the other side. So in the bulk, we have a boundary, we have a background geometry, a certain space-time metric, which describes that bulk geometry. That corresponds to a state in the boundary theory, for which there are certain prescriptions to get that correspondence specifically. And each of the examples oscillator on is based on such a correspondence. So each one starts with a certain bulk geometry that is singular. One wants to understand that particular singularity. For that, one has to find a corresponding boundary state. And so that is coming from more specific rules of the ADS-EFT correspondence, which we will see in these examples later on. Then, to analyze these singularities, one usually uses a scalar field. So one puts a test field on the singular background geometry in the bulk. In simplest case, it's just a scalar field of a certain mass. On the boundary side, that corresponds to an operator in the conformal field theory whose conformal dimension delta is related to the mass of that scalar and also the space-time dimension of the bulk. So these are the basic ingredients for a specific situation. There's a state and an operator on the boundary side corresponding to a bulk geometry with a test field. Then the singularity can be analyzed by solving field equations for the test field. So in the bulk, one would use a propagator or Green's function of its wave equation, and that corresponds to a correlation function of the boundary operator O corresponding to phi computed in that particular boundary state corresponding to the background geometry. More specifically, that's a Whiteman function, which will play quite some role in the first example that I'm going to present here. And the specific relation is written in red here. So you take the bulk propagator, multiply it with an appropriate power of the ADS radius, of the radial coordinate of that ADS space, take the limit where that approaches infinity, so you approach the boundary, and then up to a multiple, you obtain the correlation function in the boundary. So that's a specific relation that allows one to investigate the propagation of the test field by calculations in the boundary field theory. Now, the main feature that's being used here is that in a certain limit, when both that number n, so the rank of the gauge group of the Young-Mill theory, and also the Atov coupling go to infinity, in that case, one is reproducing just classical gravity, and that follows from these two basic relations between the parameters of the theories. If these two parameters go to zero, n and lambda, then it means that the string coupling and also the string length go to zero, so there are no quantum or string effects, and one can just use classical calculations in the bulk, solve for the wave equation, for instance, for the scalar, and use that information to see how these solutions, which would have some indications of the singularities of the bulk, how that is realized in the boundary theory. So once that is understood, one can then look for possible changes that happen if n is not infinite or lambda is not infinite, and that would then could then be taken as a description of the same situation, but including quantum or string effects. So this is a general description of the idea. On slide number 9, there are more specific details. So there's a version of the Schwarzschild ADS background. So in that case, one is studying Black Hole singularities, Schwarzschild singularities. This bar geometry, according to the correspondence, is mapped to a thermal state in the boundary. That can, for instance, be inferred from periodicity statements in the Euclidean version of that correspondence. And the temperature of the thermal state, as one can expect, is just the Hawking temperature in that Schwarzschild ADS background. So that was the first step of the correspondence. Then we could classically, or on the gravity side, probe the singularity by analyzing the behavior of that scalar field. Especially if the mass of the scalar is large, then its Green's function is pretty well described by wave packets, Gaussians, for instance, depending on the initial values, that just follow the bulk geodesics. So that is, at large mass, one can use a geometric optics approximation, and that's why geodesics become relevant. And geodesics certainly can be used to, well, they are usually anyway used to analyze singularities. So by using the Green's function in that limit of large masses for that scalar, one can also use the solutions to probe the singularity and then by the ADS-CFT correspondence extrapolate that to something happening in the boundary theory. So there has to be a certain correspondence that can be seen from the correlation function, the Weidman function, corresponding to that operator for the scalar phi. Now, one could be worried here that the large mass of the scalar implies strong back reaction effects, which would be an inconsistency because one is using just the vacuum Schwarzschild ADS background, and if there's a massive scalar on it, one should think there's large back reaction. But one can also give arguments here similar to those on the previous slide, that in the limit where the rank of the gauge group becomes very large, the gravitational interaction is actually being turned off, so there is, although there is a large mass of the scalar, it is not going to give a large amount of back reaction. So the whole description in that context is self-consistent, and one can see, one can then use these correlation functions in a well-defined way to get information on geodesics and then on singularities. More specifically, that works by not really using the Weidman function directly, but its Fourier transform. And that's important because one will also have to use an analytic continuation in omega. So it's a key step here that one goes to G as a function of omega and the Fourier transformation. And then properties of that Fourier transformation poles in the complex plane is what's being related to information in the geodesics. So on slide number 10, there are some more details. So first of all, if we just look at real values of omega, one can see that that just reproduces the geodesic equation on Euclidean ADS. That's the reason why one has to use an analytic continuation, because Euclidean ADS doesn't have a singularity, so one certainly wants to describe Lorentzian ADS and its singularity in this context. That can be done by analytically continuing the Fourier transform of the Weidman function to imaginary values of frequency, and that corresponds to space-like geodesics in Lorentzian ADS. So that correspondence is seen by comparing an equation that the Weidman function, or that Fourier transform rather, has to satisfy with the geodesic equation in Lorentzian ADS, and they just agree in this case. So that frequency is related to certain initial values for a particle following that geodesic. And since these are space-like geodesics in Lorentzian ADS, some of them cross the horizon and would approach singularity. So one can select those particular geodesics and see if their behavior is changed if one switches on quantum or string effects. There are some more details that one can extract. There are formulas here which show that even a quasi-normal mode can also be seen in the correlation functions. So the main results that one has classically are in fact reproduced in the limit where n goes to infinity and lambda goes to infinity. So these quasi-normal modes, for instance, correspond to poles of the Fourier transform of the Weidman function, and also the singularity, the fact that there is a singularity in the bulk, which is noticed by the geodesic equation, can be related to a certain behavior and accumulation points of the poles of the Fourier transform Weidman function in the complex plane. So all that is happening when n goes to infinity and lambda goes to infinity, so that's just purely classical gravity formulated in terms of the boundary field theory. But now, at the boundary side, one cannot fully compute all these correlation functions that one would like to know, but one can at least analyze the analytic structure, and what one can notice is that if one goes to finite n, so one is switching on quantum gravity effects according to the ADS-CFT correspondence, then the analytic structure changes quite significantly. So the poles that one had initially for n going to infinity corresponding to quasi-normal modes and also to the singularity all merge, and instead of poles one has branch cuts. Also, the fall-off behavior at infinity in the complex plane changes, and all this can be related, it's understood as the fact that all the structure that allowed one to recognize the horizon, the singularity, and quasi-normal modes in the classical limit just disappears when quantum effects are switched on. So the classical structures are understood to emerge in the classical limit, but they are supposedly not there in real quantum gravity described by the ADS-CFT correspondence. So that is the main statement on singularities that's being made here. It is certainly not a very specific geometrical picture, so one can make statements on the emergence or possible disappearance of singularities, but currently at least there's no specific or interpretation on how that's happening. Also, as one can see, that analytic continuation is used quite significantly, and in particular the fact that the that one can analytically continue, so that the initial Weidman function is analytic and also its Fourier transform. So one might think that if one looks at more complicated situations, more characteristic for collapse which are not static, which include back reaction effects and possibly evaporation, that would require interaction terms, and usually interacting quantum field theories are not described by Weidman functions, but one needs a Feynman propagator, and that would be non-analytic. There's a time ordering function which is not analytic. So that might be a problem in extending that scenario. And also, because of the appearance of time ordering, one would have to refer to a time coordinate, so the choice of time, which is anyway a difficult situation in relativistic situations, could also be much more serious in an extension of that particular example used here. But it does certainly give one possibility which shows how quantum effects could resolve singularities, and that is the most specific that has been formulated in the context of the ADS-CFT correspondence. There's another example. Sure.
So, since this is the most specific example, I got two questions really. Namely, if you look at the ADS-CFT correspondence that you wrote down in slide number 8, there the correspondence between the Green's functions, even in principle, is such that the boundary Whiteman function, or whatever Green's functions we have on the boundary, will only give us the limiting value of the Green's function in the bulk. So if space-time in the bulk were not analytic, even if there was a, you know, because of black hole evaporation or even just a slight gravitational wave or something, then I would only be able to get information about the limiting values at infinity of the bulk Green's function. Seems that we would never be able to get any information about, you know, the horizons or anything happening inside. The only reason we could do this so far was because of analyticity of the bulk space-time in Schwarzschild antidissiter. So it's not just a matter of technicality. It seems to me that there is really just no prescription, I mean, not even a general idea about how one would be able to get something that is happening deep inside the space-time, such as the horizons and so on, in absence of analyticity. Do you agree, Martin, or is this something, is there more to it than what is on the slide?
Well, I certainly haven't seen more to it. I wouldn't say that there's not more, but otherwise I would agree. It certainly looks difficult to extend these ideas to any situation which would not be analytic, which is the general objection that one might have anyway, that anything beyond the horizon would be hard to see from just the boundary. So, yeah, I certainly agree with that statement, but since I'm certainly not fully familiar with this investigation, I cannot say that there is not more than
right.
That.
Right. I did not certainly mean that there is not in principle more, but there is not more that we have seen or you have seen, was the question.
Right.
But even in this analytic case now, which is now on the transparency plan that you have, okay, so the poles merge, so all I can really conclude is that the structure of singularity is different. Why is the appearance of branch cut in place of poles telling us that in the bulk geometry, according to string theory, there is no singularity? I mean, I don't see any relation between, you know, existence of branch cuts and non-singular behavior.
Okay, yeah, there's certainly more to it in this case, which are technical details. So there's a detailed analysis on the fall-off conditions of the fall-off behavior of the Fourier transformed Whiteman function if you approach infinity along the imaginary axis. That also has been related to properties of the geodesic equation, and especially to what's happening at singularities. So here there's certainly much more, which I just didn't have the time to include here. So I think these arguments are quite convincing if one looks at the papers at details. But it also requires much more time to explain all of that convincingly. So. But otherwise, it would be interesting to see that in more detail. Unfortunately, I didn't find a simple argument to present that, but just the general statement. So then to continue now with the cosmological example in the same spirit, that on slide number 11, it uses similar ideas, but it's not as specific, so it need to use additional approximations, which is mainly because it also deals with a much more non-trivial background, which is cosmological, dynamical, and not static as a Schwarzschild ADS. So that's why that is not as precise as the analysis before. That is one example which does not use analyticity, because it's probably not going to be realized, but there are some alternative statements that one can make. So first of all, we have to start again with the initial setup of the correspondence. So there's a scalar field which has a certain fall-off behavior as we approach the boundary. And that fall-off behavior now becomes important because it relates to properties of some of these boundary operators. And also, it can be used to identify the background. There's always a term that's falling off like 1 by R, but an instanton analysis shows that the next order term, 1 by R squared, would vanish in a static background, but would be non-zero in a cosmological background. So that parameter, beta, the coefficient of that term, can be used to distinguish those two backgrounds. First of all, in the static case, when beta is zero, one can completely formulate the correspondence. So in this case, the boundary operator is just the boundary value of the scalar squared. That's an operator of conformal dimension 1, and if we check the corresponding equation between boundary values of the scalar and expectation values of the boundary operator, then one can verify, again using rules of the correspondence, that this coefficient alpha that determines the leading term in the fall-off behavior of the scalar is just corresponding to the expectation value of the boundary operator in the state that one would have in the correspondence for the bulk geometry. So in this case, because it's a static background, it can all be described quite reliably. If one is switching on the cosmological dynamics, so if beta becomes non-zero, the situation becomes more difficult because one has to deal with interacting conformal field theories. So there are arguments which also here I cannot give in any detail, which tell us that instead of having a free action, just this phi squared term, basically that we had in the static background, there's an interaction term which is a cubic power of that boundary operator O. So if we use a correspondence between O and phi, we just insert phi squared, use that in the action S, so we have the free action as naught, and the interaction term, then we can read off a potential which is phi squared from the free action, but this cubic term in O gives us a fixed power potential in the for phi, and it comes with a minus sign because, well, it was with a plus in the action, and that coefficient k there can also be seen to be positive. So it's a potential that's unbounded below, and if we just take that as a classical potential, there are any solution except for unstable ones are runaway solutions which reach infinity in a finite amount of time, and that can be related in this picture to the bulk geometry approaching its cosmological singularity in a finite amount of proper time. Now, this potential here is just written for a single parameter, and the scalar certainly is a field, so that potential is supposed to be relevant for each mode of the field. So also here one is doing, well, here it's a Fourier transformation or some decomposition of the scalar on the background, and one has a certain potential that is describing the behavior of each mode of the field. Now, here one can also arrive at certain expectations from possible quantization. So classically we have these runaway solutions. If we quantize the system just first as a classical mechanical system, then we should be able to find a self-adjoint extension of the corresponding Hamiltonian, which would give us unitary evolution. So even after that finite amount of time at which the scalar would have reached infinity in the classical case, the quantum evolution would still continue since it's unitary. And that can be understood as choosing through the self-adjoint extension certain boundary conditions at infinity which reflect off the scalar and then make it turn back to finite values. So that is what one can expect if one applies just quantum mechanics to a single mode of that scalar. And since that potential was derived in the context of cosmology, infinity corresponding to the cosmological singularity, this reflecting behavior can be taken as an indication for the occurrence of a bounce. So the scalar would be reflected off infinity, which would mean that in the bulk description, the scalar field, together with the bulk geometry, would bounce off, remain well-defined, and not reach a singularity. So these statements are certainly much more vague than what one could do by these precise analytic continuations in the Schwarzschild case. It certainly has the advantage that it does not rely on these analytic continuations, and it can also deal with dynamical geometries, but then through these interactions that occur, it also makes the analysis more complicated. And there are further open issues. What I described so far was basically just for a single mode, but each mode is described by such a potential. So in general, one would have to choose a parameter characterizing that self-adjoint extension really for the field theory. So one could think of that as giving a free parameter for each mode, and which would be infinitely many free parameters that one needs to choose. It's not clear if that or how that could be determined by string theory, which is supposed to be the underlying theory corresponding to that description. And also, the self-adjoint extension would determine what kind of bounds occurs and at which time it occurs. So if each mode has a different self-adjoint extension, a different parameter, then also the bounds would be different for each mode. It could be happening at different times, and then it's not clear if one should really understand that as a single bounds, or if it could even be understood in that way, or a rather more complicated description, which might still be non-singular, but it's also, in that case, not clear what specific realization there is of singularity resolution. So that is the end of the ADS-CFT examples. On slide number 12, I just have very brief remarks on the other cases. The first one was using perturbative string theory, especially tachyon condensation. So there are certain winding modes which one can analyze and see to give certain, at least effective, matter contributions if they are really present in a theory. And these effective matter contributions allow one to give arguments that they might avoid singularities, although in this case and also in the next one, what has really been analyzed are not curvature singularities and also not space-like ones, but null singularities at which the curvature does not blow up. And then there are certain extrapolations to what might happen in other cases for curvature singularities. So what's suggested here is a bounce. It's not a bounce, but rather something similar to a theory of initial conditions. So instead of having a bouncing geometry that continues, space-time is closed off topologically, and the initial state is described supposedly by that condensate of the tachyon field. But as I said, that has only been done for null singularities, really, and it's not so clear how that really relate to cosmological or even black hole singularities. That statement is also true for the next example of matrix models. Here, the basic idea is that one describes the manifold, the space-time manifold, not in the usual way, but through matrices, which in general are non-commuting, but in a certain limit in which they would become all diagonal, they would commute, and in that limit one can understand the diagonal components as space-time coordinates, but that would only be realized in a certain limit, in a classical limit, but it would not be true in deep quantum regimes. So the idea that's proposed here is also one of an emergence of classical space-time, which would be replaced by a more complicated, more quantum structure on smaller scales, especially close to singularities. So that can also be used to make certain suggestions for resolutions, but also here it has been done only for null singularities without curvature blow-up. Then the final example in that context is using some ideas of string theory, but not really quantum gravity. It's rather an analysis in supergravity. It's a combination with some BKL ideas, which makes it quite interesting in this context here. And the main statement is that something like the BKL picture is realized in that analysis, but if one approaches a singularity, there are more degrees of freedom that are hidden in classical GR, in non-supersymmetric gravity, but which would become relevant near singularity. And near the singularity, geometry is supposed to be described by a sigma model with this infinite dimensional target space for all these infinitely many new degrees of freedom that are emerging. And this sigma model is formulated on a time axis, so it doesn't have spatial extensions. Instead, it has all these infinitely many new degrees of freedom in the target space, which also is supposed to describe the full behavior, and even in certain limits, the general behavior that we see in the approach to singularities in GR. So these are the main examples that were discussed at the workshop. So as one could see, the main details were on ADS-CFT, but there are also other and quite different scenarios that are being discussed. So are there any questions at this point? I'm going to finish, well, I did just finish with the string examples and will now turn to loop quantum gravity. So if there are no questions, I will start with the basic features that are relevant for singularities on slide number 13. So as probably everybody here in this audience knows, the basic features are that one uses holonomies instead of connection components, which are bounded functions, which is quite important. And instead of using continuous geometrical fields, one has a spatial geometry that's described by flux operators with discrete spectra. So these are two statements which give information on the quantum geometry that's realized, and it certainly differs from classical geometry, so it might also have implications on singularities, which are a consequence of classical or differential geometry. So to analyze singularities dynamically, one also has to formulate the field equations, which is written in this context as a constraint equation, the Hamiltonian constraint. The main steps in the construction of such operators are an expression of curvature components that appear in the classical constraint through holonomies, and also the tried components, especially inverse powers that appear in the classical constraint, also have to be quantized, which is not obvious because they have discrete spectra. Well, the flux operators themselves have discrete spectra containing zero, so there's no obvious inverse. But as is used quite often by now, one can still quantize such expressions by using certain classical identities, but we formulate inverse powers in terms of Poisson brackets that don't involve any inverse power, and then the Poisson bracket and its ingredients can just be quantized more or less directly. So that allows one to quantize the inverses that appear in the constraint, and curvature components are quantized in terms of all anomalies along closed loops that one has to choose in a certain way, but which can at least be constructed in a class of candidates of Hamiltonian constraint operators. So these two ingredients, the way that inverse powers are quantized and the way that curvature components are expressed through Hall anomalies, have implications also for singularities. So one obtains a certain equation that describes the quantum dynamics, and the steps that enter the quantization certainly have implications also for solutions to the constraints. Some effects are briefly described on slide number 14. So if one looks at these quantizations of inverse volume or inverse triad components, not in the full theory where these operators are still quite complicated, but in isotropic models, they turn out to be finite. So that's already an indication that maybe also curvature is better behaved even if we approach zero volume, which classically would give rise to a singularity. One can also probe this in the full theory without assuming symmetries by computing expectation values of those operators in certain approximations in coherent states, and then have the peak position of those states follow a classical trajectory that would approach an isotropic singularity. And also, in this case, even though symmetries are not used at the quantum level, although classically to determine the peak position, also here these expectation values remain bounded. So that's a further indication that these statements even go through without assuming symmetries, possibly, although it's certainly not a completely fully understood issue. Especially the operator itself, rather than just expectation values in coherent states that would correspond to inverse volume in the full theory, it has been analyzed to some degree, but it's not, its properties are not completely known, and which makes it even more difficult to use that for the understanding of singularities, is that in the full theory it's difficult to relate any configuration to singularities because we just don't know what a general singularity looks like in the full theory. We only know that specifically in symmetric cases. But if one wants to go beyond symmetric models, that certainly makes it quite difficult to pin down any properties of singularities because even classically they are so poorly understood. So one can analyze certain properties of operators, but turning that into statements on singularities requires much more insight. Also, in the arguments that exist without symmetry so far, one uses coherent states. So one certainly has to see also what's happening to these coherent states and to the coherence if one really follows quantum evolution, and then usually the coherence would be lost after some time, well before one approaches singularity. So one should also know what's happening to these expectation values in much more general states. So this is basically just a very brief review on what's known about these inverse volume operators. There's a more specific statement that's also more sensitive to dynamics, which relates to different equations that one can write down in symmetric models which are equivalent to the Hamiltonian constraint. And this different equation then can be analyzed usually more easily, and it also, because it refers to symmetric situations, allows one to isolate phases which would correspond to classical singularity and then see how that different equation behaves around those phases and possibly resolve the classical singularity. In more specific models, which are not just symmetric but also specify the matter content, one can even complete the program and compute a physical Hilbert space, so the physical inner product, and not just solve the constraint equation itself as a different equation, one can compute observables and by this way obtain not only a complete construction of the quantization, but also through an evaluation of observables and also some numerical solutions, one obtains a detailed and also a more intuitive, more geometrical picture of how the singularity is resolved. So on the next slide, number 15, there are a few remarks on the difference equation. I don't have so much time to go through it. So one first specializes such a Hamiltonian constraint operator to an isotropic model. It still shows the main feature, so there's a difference here on the top equation, a difference of volume eigenvalues, which is coming from commutators that one obtains by quantizing Poisson brackets, and there are states with a label that's being shifted, and that's coming from the quantization of these curvature components. The latter is also the reason why we obtain a difference equation. If we now transform to a triad representation, so we write the state as a superposition of triad eigenstates, which are just these states with label mu here, mu as a triad eigenvalue, then we obtain the difference equation on the lower half of that slide, which one can analyze. So starting with some initial values, one can evolve and see what's happening, especially at mu equals zero, which would correspond to vanishing volume eigenvalues or to the classical singularity. Now, the difference equation just continues, so that was the original argument that singularities are resolved quite generally, so also that doesn't necessarily give a geometrical picture, but it's an argument that's general in this isotropic model and also in anisotropic and some inhomogeneous ones that have been formulated in the meantime. There are further properties on slide number 16. So first one relates solutions to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So instead of having that function on a discrete space in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, you would have a function depending on a scale factor. And the behavior here would be quite different because the Wheeler-DeWitt equation would not give such an extension beyond the classical singularity. The wave function would just be supported on positive scale factors, and there would be no obvious way to evolve across the classical singularity. So there's an extension of the not only solutions, but the whole Hilbert space that's happening in the loop quantization, and as I mentioned, that has been extended to less symmetric models. Even in inhomogeneous cases, not based on the BKL picture, and so far it's not clear if the BKL picture can be used in that context. So there's no obvious way that these equations would respect a similar perspective. Now, these statements are general. They avoid using the physical inner product because they are statements about any solution. But certainly, one needs the physical inner product, physical states, in order to determine expectation values of observables, for instance, and derive a more geometrical picture. This is possible in a model that's sourced by a free scalar. It's briefly reviewed on slide number 17. So the Hamiltonian in the free case without a metric potential allows one to write the difference equation in a Klein-Gordon type form. That's because there's no potential, so there's no phi dependence, and so phi can be used as like a time parameter in the Klein-Gordon equation, and one can analyze the equation by similar means, compute the physical inner product, also by similar techniques to the Klein-Gordon equation, and then analyze the solution. In this case, one can show analytically and also numerically that there's really a specific picture of how the singularity is resolved. So if one starts with an initial semi-classical state, it follows initially the classical trajectory, but does not approach a singularity, but bounces off at some non-zero volume, which is determined by an effective equation like the one that one can see at the bottom of slide number 17. Now, the specific place depend on how exactly the constraint is quantized, but in each case, depending on certain ambiguities, there is a bounds. Just the value depends on the specific quantization, but not the fact that it does bounds. Now, this model can also be formulated in a more analytical way, so one can choose different variables, change the Hamiltonian slightly to get a system which is exactly solvable, so the basic variables and the Hamiltonian form a closed algebra, which one can use to determine exact solutions. There are few details on slide number 18, which I don't have time to go through all of which. But the main statement is, first of all, that the effective equation that I showed on the previous slide can be justified by that analysis because one has linear Hamiltonian, and the expectation value of that linear Hamiltonian is exactly the effective Hamiltonian. If it would not be linear, there would be additional terms which would be corrections to the effective expression, which would not be included if one just uses the sign C instead of C as in the previous equation. So this model can be analyzed in quite some detail by different techniques. It's certainly very helpful that it's related so closely to a solvable model, but it also means that some of its properties are special because of the solvability. Solvability disappears if there's a meta potential or anisotropies or inhomogeneities. In that case, there would be much stronger quantum back reaction effects. The state would not remain exactly Gaussian. If it's initially Gaussian, it would spread and deform, and that spreading and deformations would have back reaction effects on the expectation values, which can be quite significant, especially during long evolution times. So this still has to be analyzed, but because there is such a solvable model which can be analyzed in detail, including the physical inner product, one can use this to perturb around the model and see what the behavior of solutions is if the model is not exactly of this form. So there's a way to get specific information even in more realistic cases. So this was the most specific example that we have in new quantum gravity, which also finishes examples. In this case, I just have a few more slides on general remarks and discussions that happened on slide number 19. There are examples for the main strengths and weaknesses that were perceived, at least in discussions during the workshop. First, positive things about string theory, according to the average participant, is that there's a trusted framework in the ADS-CFT correspondence, so everybody accepts that this should be, well, at least in string theory, that this should be the framework that allows one, that is first of all well-defined, well, it's not completely defined, but the ideas at least are well-formulated, and calculations can be done, some of them, and it gives some information. If analyticity is realized, this can really be used to get a strong relation between bulk geometry and boundary behavior, although, of course, the analyticity itself might be a problem, or at least the assumption of analyticity that is necessary. Another thing is that there are independent results from perturbative string theory and at least some scenarios which one can compare with what is obtained in the ADS-CFT correspondence, although it's quite different at the current stage. Now, there are a few negative things which were mentioned. It's, first of all, a lack of a non-perturbative formulation that would be applicable to cosmology. As we saw in that one cosmological example, whenever there are dynamical background statements become much more vague, so there's no fully formulated non-perturbative formulation. Also, perturbation theory itself would be much more difficult in such time-dependent backgrounds. Much of perturbative string theory is based on Riemannian surfaces, on Riemann surfaces, but if one has time-dependent backgrounds, one would have to analyze something like Lorentzian metrics on those surfaces, and that is tricky, to say the least. And finally, a negative thing is that the space-time geometry, as we also saw that in these examples, is obtained only very indirectly, so it's not easy to get any specific geometrical pictures, especially concerning singularities. Loop quantum gravity had several positive remarks, all of which somehow were related to singularities themselves, not to the general theory. There's a set of general statements. They are indications, also general, for bounded curvature, and as we saw here, some models which allow one to derive a detailed geometrical picture. The main negative statements were on the full framework, so there are doubts on the constraints, the quantization, and the algebra. It's, people would like to see that, at least in effective equations and semi-classical regimes, Lorentz violating terms are not too strong. And also, the non-uniqueness was an issue, and to some degree, the non-separability of some Hilbert spaces, at least, that are being used. There are also common problems on slide number 20, just quick listing. The question is, in each case, how state-dependent the singularity resolution mechanism is that one uses. Also, gauge dependence might play a role. In loop quantum gravity, one often uses mini or midi superspaces, which require certain choice. Or in the ADS-CFT correspondence, one uses specific backgrounds, which also is a gauge choice. There's a problem of observables. It's important for both approaches. It's required to extract specific information from a wave function in a canonical quantization, such as loop quantum gravity, or to extract local bulk properties in the ADS-CFT correspondence. Similar statements can be made about the problem of time. One needs that for observables, possibly, to interpret the wave function, and also in ADS-CFT if one has non-static bulks. So the final slide is number 21. To summarize, most of the examples that were introduced are very specific. So it looks like the situation in classical GR, which initially presented several specific examples of singularities before general theorems were proven, we also at a stage before theorems, so we just have specific examples that tell us some properties, and one has to guess basically at the current stage whether or not these are generic. If one tries to generalize it, there are often quite a set of combined difficulties which makes it quite difficult to generalize, and in only in a few cases is it clear how such a generalization might change the picture. So most cases, because they are so specific, refer to singularities whose structure is precisely known classically, and also that is not a good starting point for general statements, although that might be the place where the BKL picture could help, because that would give one a way, if it's realized, to extend from these specific cases to more general ones. Also, again, referring to the specificity is that all these singularities that have been analyzed had diverging curvature. And it's not clear from this theorem that this is really a general statement. It's certainly a pressing issue, but it might not be what one has to discuss for general theorems on resolutions of singularities. So currently it appears that whatever has been done is a good consistency test so far of quantum gravity candidates, but probably not a precise statement, certainly not a robust one, on general resolutions of singularities. So I think these were the main issues that were being discussed and summarized here. So that's why I stop. And we have about 10 minutes for questions. 5 minutes for questions.
While people are still thinking, let me just make one small comment. I think it was implicit in what Martin said. But in the slide about comparison between string theory and loop quantum gravity and so on, which was, I think, slide 19. The first point about ADS-CFT, and just to be completely fair, people in string theory, almost all of them, kept repeatedly saying to us that that it's very nice to have ADS-CFT, something trusted, and so on, but it's also, quote, a very tiny corner of the full theory because of use of boundary conditions, which are not so realistic, etc., etc. So they are not saying that this is full quantum gravity, at least in, you know, at least in our discussions, but they are saying that this is just a tiny corner of it.
Any questions by now?
Okay, Jorge, are there any announcements for next week?
So next week we don't have a seminar because it's May 1st and there's a lot of people on holidays. And we don't have any speakers booked for the last two slots of this semester. So if anyone wants to come up here, please write me.
Okay, let's thank Martin again.